Welcome to the Who's Counting podcast with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Hello, I'm Cleta Mitchell. Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast about everything having to do with American elections, how elections are supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do about it. And today, we are in the process of learning about the coverage and information about election issues. And one of the best writers on the scene today, who is very dedicated to reporting about election integrity, is Sean Fleetwood, who's a staff writer at The Federalist. So thanks for joining us, Sean.
Thank you for having me. You make me sound a lot better than I really am, but thank you.
No, Sean, we really appreciate it because you are really a busy person and you are very prolific in all the writing you do to cover these topical issues. And, you know, those of us who are in the election integrity movement really appreciate it because we so rarely get coverage about the work that the election integrity movement people are doing all over the country that isn't something that's attacking us. I just literally had an email from a reporter. I use that term reporter from the New York Times wanting to inquire about a meeting that I had with some North Carolina legislators back in May. And the point of the meeting was just to talk about here are things that are some problems in the current statute and things that you might consider that need to be addressed. And of course, the left has taken that, spins it as some kind of terrible, horrible, that wicked witch of the West is involved in looking at North Carolina's election code. So honestly, Sean, it's really nice to have some people who just cover the facts and the situation, and we really appreciate what you do.
Thank you. You're very kind. And I feel like we're one of the only outlets that doesn't use the term election denier in a serious way. So that's always great, too.
It's true. So, Sean, before we get started talking about some of your work, tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you got to be a writer. And did you always want to be a writer? And how did you end up at The Federalist?
Yeah, I live in Fredericksburg, Virginia, born and raised here my whole life. I was one of those kids who graduated high school having no idea what they wanted to do with their lives. All my friends knew what they wanted to major in. They knew what they wanted their careers to be, what schools they wanted to go to, and I just had no idea. I started getting interested in politics around the 2016 election, so when I was about a sophomore, junior in high school. But then I went to college and I started writing for the school paper there and I fell in love with it. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. I didn't know you could actually make a career out of this. And so my sophomore year, I actually came back to community college here in Fredericksburg. And I, of course, there's no, you know, school paper for the community college. So I was looking for outlets that accepted public submissions. And I came across The Federalist. I was a big fan of their work, you know, what they did with debunking the Russia collusion hoax and the Kavanaugh hearings. And I sent in a submission. This is about the summer of 2019, and they accepted it. And so from then on, I just sort of became an irregular contributor. And then May of 2021, I became an intern. And then last August is when I officially became a staff writer. So
that is a great story. I love that. I love that. Well, tell everybody what The Federalist is.
So The Federalist is a conservative-based news outlet that's going to give you the takes and the information that you're not going to hear from legacy media. We try and offer perspective from the common citizen, you know, the everyday American who's out there working, whether it's blue-collar jobs, white-collar jobs, whatever, that's something that's outside the DC bubble. And that's what's actually really unique about The Federalist is that we're not all stationed in DC. We're scattered throughout the country. We have people in the West. We have people all the way up in Alaska. We have people in the South. I mean, just everywhere. So that, I think, gives us an advantage over some other news outlets that are so heavily concentrated in these, you know, cities like Washington, D.C. and New York City and L.A. and all these other places. So, if you're looking for information or takes that are going to be different that you're not going to see on cable news at night, then take a look at TheFederalist.com.
And how would people go about subscribing to The Federalist?
Yeah, so we have a free daily newsletter where you can get articles in your inbox every morning. But we also recently, within the past couple months, launched a subscription service. So you can pay $4 a month or $40 a year, and you get access to articles with no ads, our comment section, and exclusive content that we put out on the website. Very recently, with the Durham Report dropping, people like Molly Hemingway, Emily Jashinsky, our culture editor, and several other of our members of our staff put out this about hour-long breakdown of the Durham Report, everything you need to know. So yeah, if you're interested and you want to help us out and help us grow, then by all means, please subscribe to The Federalist.
And people can do that by just going to thefederalist.com.
Yep, you can go to thefederalist.com, and there's a little tab there where you can hit subscribe, and it'll walk you through the process.
Well, that I highly recommend it, because honestly, I learned so much by reading The Federalist. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, there's so many issues that come up all the time in the election space. And I'd ask you to send along some of your recent writings about some different topics. There's so many. Yeah. I'm sure you have a long list that grows every day. So talk about how you manage to try to keep up with and cover. How do you decide what it is you think that the readership needs to know?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, I want to give a big shout out to you and Molly Hemingway. You guys have been such a great help. And, you know, Molly's been such a great mentor to me in this whole process. She wrote that great book, Rigged, that came out back in 2021, detailing about a lot of what happened in the 2020 election. And she's just been such a great resource and, again, a mentor for me. So I wouldn't be where I am without her. But usually my process just starts every morning. I subscribe to various groups and online websites like the Election and Transparency Initiative. They send out a newsletter every morning. It's super helpful because it includes a lot of links and news reports that have been released that day of election related stories. And so I usually look for, you know, legislation that's been passed. If it's, you know, during the state legislative sessions, significant issues like ranked choice voting. And I always think of, you know, what angles on elections and election related subjects are the media going for, and how can I counteract those false narratives? Because again, to go back to the whole election denier thing, they're so quick to label any criticisms or reporting on, you know, errors in our election system as, you know, election denialism, that, you know, these serious issues get swept under the rug. So I always try and look for issues that will, you know, people will care about and that are important, that they're not going to hear from legacy media.
Well, I remember one conversation that I had actually with Molly Hemingway about the Election Transparency Initiative newsletter, where it's a collection of headlines, links to articles around the country. And 99% of the articles are bashing those of us who care about election integrity. And I said something to Molly about it. I said, this is so disheartening. And she said, I don't care, pick an issue. And if there were a newsletter about that issue, they'd be bashing conservatives. That's just what they do.
Yeah.
I hadn't ever really thought about that, but seeing it all in one place every day or every other day, however often they publish, I'm just always, you know, the news that the legacy media seem to not even pay much attention to, having to do with the backstory on the letter that was organized by Anthony Blinken and back in the fall of 2020 to discredit the information about Hunter Biden's laptop. Can you talk about what exactly happened and how you analyzed that and wrote about it?
Yeah, so just kind of as a refresher, everyone kind of remembers in the weeks leading up to the 2020 election, the New York Post came out with this bombshell report about Hunter Biden's laptop that showed, you know, the Biden's family's foreign business dealings. And so we just found out from an IRS whistleblower's actually that the FBI had authenticated that laptop as early as November of 2019.
Oh, my gosh.
Almost a year before the laptop story even broke. But what's even more remarkable is that we know that in the months leading up to the 2020 election, the FBI was going to big tech companies like Twitter, like Facebook, warning them of this impending Russian disinformation and that hacked materials, you know, just to be on the lookout for that. In case you guys want to censor that, a nod and a wink. And of course, we know that's exactly what they did. You know, Twitter claimed that they were hacked materials. Of course, they had no evidence of this. They censored it. You couldn't even send the story over direct message. We know that Facebook throttled the reach of the story. You couldn't really share it, or it didn't get a large enough reach. So we know that the FBI went to these companies, willingly lied to them. But even if they had told them the truth, I'm sure they would have censored it anyways, just given their track record. But then we come to find out, of course, that the letter that was issued after the New York Post release of the story from over 50 intelligence community officials who claimed that this has all the hallmarks of Russian disinformation, we know that the FBI solicited signatures for that. We have a top FBI official who's testified under oath to the Republicans in the House that Antony Blinken, who at the time was working on the Biden campaign, had actually called him up to discuss the letter. And that had he not called him, he would never have gotten the idea to write the letter, sign on to the letter. And he said this was because he wanted Joe Biden to win the presidency. So you have blatant federal interference in our election processes in the 2020 election. And we know because of the Durham report that they also interfered in the 2016 election as well.
So when you say they interfered, who were they? Who were they who did the interfering?
So they're the top officials at the FBI and CIA, our intel community, if you will, who thinks that they know better about who should run our government than the American people do. And now what's even more interesting is you have Joe Biden and the Biden administration again interfering in the election. Back in March of 2021, he issued this executive order, which essentially mandates that federal agencies conduct voter registration activities or to find ways to engage in voter registration. And this has never been done before, that he's actually mandating agencies to do this. And in the executive order, agencies are required to adopt this strategic plan, is what it's called, to lay out how they're planning to do this. And you have good government groups like the Foundation for Government Accountability and all these other organizations that have filed lawsuits and FOIA requests trying to get these documents. And of the documents that they have gotten, they've just been almost completely redacted. The Biden administration is concealing all these efforts about what exactly they're doing. We do know that they're coordinating with so-called bipartisan groups for these voter registration activities. But as the Daily Signal just reported the other week, the Indian Health Service, which falls under HHS, they're working with groups like the ACLU and Demos and all these other left-wing groups for the purposes of voter registration. So the idea that this is any kind of nonpartisan venture is just such a fallacy.
Well, the thing that is interesting to me is that we've not been able to get any information about where that executive order also calls for grants to approved NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And I don't know of any member of Congress who's gotten a single response that that identifies who are these groups who got our tax dollars to participate in voter education or voter participation. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see if we ever got the information that groups headed by Michelle Obama and Valerie Jarrett, they each have their own groups for getting college students to vote. And I would not be a bit surprised to see that those funds, our funds, went to turn out those Democratic voters. But the thing that I want to come back to this, the intelligence officials and FBI officials it seemed they were proactive. I mean, have we published all their names? Who are the main people, the names of the people? I sometimes think that they hide behind titles, and maybe we should do a better job of listing their names.
Right. I mean, so in the 2016 election, obviously we had people like James Comey, Andrew McCabe, and people like that. The 2020...
Peter Strzok.
Right. Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, all of these high-level players. The 2020, in the lead up to the New York Post meddling there, That's a little trickier. We do know this was under the Trump administration, which makes this even more concerning that, you know, how aware was Bill Barr of this? Were people deceiving Bill Barr about exactly what was going on with this type of investigation? Was the DOJ's tax division lying to Bill Barr? You know, there's a lot of questions there that I think we still need answers to about exactly, you know, who was calling the shots here. You know, the IRS whistleblowers have said that when they were launching this investigation, that they were warned up front, like, hey, you know, better be careful here. We don't really want to, you know, get too involved in the lead up to an election. But yet, for some reason, the FBI and the DOJ had no problem interfering in the 2020 election by lying to big tech companies and saying that Russian disinformation was on the way. So exactly the specific players, I think we're going to be uncovering that in the months ahead as these whistleblowers come forward and as the House gets their hands on more material. So hopefully that those will provide some answers for us.
So do you cover all of those hearings, those oversight hearings where they're supposedly releasing all this information?
I do sometimes. Luckily, we have enough staff writers who can kind of cover when one of us are busy. I'm usually tackling like more election related stuff, and I've been doing military reporting and reporting on military readiness lately. So I try and cover the hearings and you know, get filled in as much as I can. Our senior legal correspondent, Margot Cleveland, does a great job. I would encourage everyone to read her stuff. It's just such a helpful, simplistic breakdown of everything that's going on. So whenever I'm not covering that stuff, I try and read her stuff because I know I'm going to be filled in that way.
Yeah, Margot is great. She really does write. She sorts through all the legalese pretty well.
Yeah, they were very much concerned, obviously, about the Durham report, but more so with what they saw with the 2020 interference, the fact that you had now Secretary of State Antony Blinken going to the intel community and saying, hey, what can we do here to kind of push back on this, you know, Hunter Biden laptop story? And I think they were very much concerned about that issue. Secretary Warner has even called for Secretary Blinken to be impeached, which I think is absolutely a valid, you know, thing to do. I mean, because he actually went before Congress and has willfully lied about his contacts with Hunter Biden. So there's definitely grounds for impeachment there. But yeah, they were very much concerned about the federal government consistently attempting to influence the electoral process, influence voters and how they, you know, vote ahead of major elections. And I, you know, I'm not going to obviously speak too much about our private conversations, but they were very much concerned about what's going to happen in 2024 and how the federal government is attempting to influence that election as well.
Well, I think one way that they may be influencing the election is by this plea agreement that's been offered to Hunter Biden. And what we're learning about how the people at the highest levels of the federal government were basically protecting Hunter Biden from prosecution for serious tax evasion and other criminal activities.
Yeah, and you know, the felony charge related to the gun crime or gun ownership, rather, that he lied on the gun ownership form. You know, if you or I did that, you know, we'd be in jail. But of course,
people what exactly he did when you refer to that. What exactly does that mean?
So he essentially lied on the form that you fill out when you purchase a gun, essentially not telling the truth that he had a drug addiction problem. We know that he discarded the gun in some dumpster that was near a high school. And so essentially, they struck this agreement. I can't remember exactly what it was called with the DOJ to essentially allow him to agree to never purchase a gun again and not to do drugs for a certain amount of time. And that's, you know, essentially how he gets off scot-free, you know, for this agreement that's going.
And yet and this administration is pushing to prosecute lawful gun owners and to try to take their guns from them. But Hunter Biden getting off. I mean, it just makes me crazy.
And the media thinks that this was a solid, good punishment for Hunter Biden. And in fact, they think that, you know, the fact that Hunter Biden is enduring this drug addiction, obviously it is tragic, but they're trying to make like that's the main story here, that this is a father and his son who are going through this tough journey together. It's just complete state regime approved propaganda. It's not news. It's just complete garbage.
You know, it's funny you would call it the state regime because I decided back during the Obama administration that the media in the U.S. was no different from Venezuela's state-owned media. It's really, and I started thinking, well, they're really the state-owned media, even though the government doesn't own them in terms of financial ownership, that the left wing of the government owns everything that comes out of their mouths back during the Obama administration. And I think that that continues today. We all cast about for the, I just refuse to call them the mainstream media. They're not mainstream. They're very extreme. And they only represent a very tiny percentage of the American people. And yet they have such dominant control. It's really pretty frightening, actually. But I love it. They are a state-owned media.
Yeah, and Molly always tells me, if you ever use mainstream media in an article, I will scold you. That's a big no-no at the Federalist. Yeah. We don't use that term. But you know, as Mark Levin wrote in his book, Unfreedom of the Press, you know, just amazing how many people from prior administrations, the Obamas, the Clintons, then go to work in media. You know, people like George Stephanopoulos. And right. I think like that it's so concerning to me how, you know, you look at a place like Hong Kong or China, the Chinese government takes in, shuts down the free press. You know, communist society is where the government takes control of the media. But now here in America, in these more Western societies, we have the media that is willingly abiding by and abetting to the government's demands, that they don't even have to be asked to censor a story that's not favorable to them or their lackeys working in the bureaucracy. That's something that's really scary to me, is that this is just a willful compliance. It's not even like they're being forced to do it.
And they all just say the same thing, and they just regurgitate the same thing over and over and over. It's just breathtaking to me.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, actually, because I just wrote an article that came out yesterday, because earlier this week, you had the Associated Press and CNN coincidentally issue articles one day after another, warning about this impending threat to Republican legislatures administering election oversight, you know, fulfilling their constitutional obligations. Right. To administer election laws. And they, you know, were writing about Georgia Republicans, Wisconsin Republicans, North Carolina passing this election integrity law. You know, it's just absolutely amazing how they just follow in lockstep with one another. They don't even have to coordinate, you know, that we know of anyways, but they don't even have to coordinate with one another. They just follow it in sync with one another.
That the Associated Press in April of last year announced that it had received this big amount of money from this consortium of left-wing foundations to cover climate change. And then in December, it made another announcement that it received all this money from these various leftist foundations to cover democracy issues. Ooh. Now, I had quit talking to the Associated Press two or three years ago, when I realized, oh my gosh, they've just become like all the rest of the leftist media. And I'm not going to talk to them anymore. They're not fact-based. They're not interested in facts. And then when I somehow ran across this little talked about, but very big grant that the Associated Press had received to cover democracy issues. And I thought, boy, now I know why they have become so terrible. And the thing that they said is, but this will not change. This funding will not change how we cover these stories. I mean, I would just rather say, like the Federalists, we're a conservative organization. We have a perspective, and we're gonna report based on what we think are the facts and the way we see it. And you know, we don't care if ever the people don't agree with it, but at least you know, okay, we're a conservative.
That's I think the biggest problem a lot of Americans have with the media is that it's one thing if you're clearly a biased outlet and you have a bias. And you make that clear to your readers. You know, we at the Federalists, we don't hide that we offer a conservative perspective. It's when media outlets go out of their way to pretend that they're objective and nonpartisan, and then just clearly are left-wing propagandists pushing a narrative.
Yeah, that's the part that's the most distressing. Well, you mentioned that Molly Hemingway's book, Rigged, and it covered a lot of information. It contained a lot of information about Mark Zuckerberg. You mentioned Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg and all the money that he poured into these targeted places in 2020, really manipulated the money, flowed through election offices and manipulated the outcome of the election. But You did a story a month or two ago, maybe a little longer ago, about a county in DeKalb County, Georgia, and talk about what happened with DeKalb County after 2020 with regard to private money.
Yeah, so CTCL, or the Center for Tech and Civic Life, is one of the main groups that Mark Zuckerberg gave hundreds of millions of dollars to, which report into the coffers of election offices around the country, as you mentioned, to, you know, alter election laws, push Democrat-backed voting policies, get out the vote in these strategically placed areas and battleground states. And so what CTCL and a bunch of these other left-wing groups have done since 2020 is formed the U.S. Alliance for Election Excellence. And this is really just a continuation of CTCL's mission to influence future elections, like in 2024. Their strategy is a bit different because after 2020, you had a lot of states that saw what happened and they passed laws banning the private funding of elections. I believe we have about 25 states at the moment. Louisiana just passed a constitutional amendment proposal that will go to the ballot in October 14th. If voters approve that, they will enshrine a ban on private election funding in their constitution. Just a little side note. But the U.S. Alliance for Election Excellence is attempting to influence future elections. And so what DeKalb County did, which is a blue enclave in Georgia, one of the most populous in Georgia, is they accepted membership into this alliance. And they announced early in February that they were accepting a $2 million grant from CTCL to use in the 2024 elections. Now, it's worth mentioning that in March 2021, Georgia passed a ban on private election funding, where they said election officials, election offices cannot directly accept private funds for the use of elections. Well, DeKalb County's found the loophole in that law. They violated the spirit of that law, and they essentially said, okay, well, if we, the election officials, can't accept it, well, then we're going to get our finance department to apply for the grant, and that's how we're going to accept it. They'll accept it. They'll funnel it to us for the future elections. And that's essentially what happened in DeKalb County.
Well, I think then what did the legislature do? They plugged what that loophole, but they didn't make them give back the money, right?
Right. That was one of the earlier provisions, I believe, in one of the earlier drafts of the legislation made DeKalb give the money back. But ultimately, the final version of the bill that was signed by Governor Kemp within the past few months, that did not make them give the money back. And actually, just kind of like a funny story about this whole thing is the article that I wrote about this, detailing the emails and the communications showing how they accepted the money and all this. Marcy McCarthy with DeKalb County GOP, who we love. She's amazing. I could spend a whole podcast talking about how much I love Marcy. She filed an open records request shortly after DeKalb accepted the money. And she got a letter back saying, we've received your records request, and here's the date you can expect it. Here's the money you have to pay. She paid the money. She doesn't hear anything back for a while. The deadline is approaching for them to give her the records over the Alliance and CTCL and all these other groups. And she emails them multiple times saying, hey, I filed this records request. I paid the money. When can I expect to get the records? Well, the deadline comes and goes. She still hears nothing back after sending emails. And she reaches out to me and she says, hey, they're dodging my emails. I haven't gotten the records. Can we do a story on this? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And so I emailed the guy that was listed on as a contact on the form that they sent her. And within the hour of me sending that email, he finally responds back to her and says, sorry about the delay. We'll get them to you by the end of the week, no charge. Doesn't respond to me, but finally just decides coincidentally to respond to her after the press finally starts putting their feet to the fire. So, I mean, that just shows you how sleazy these people are. I mean, the fact that not only they're willing to go around election laws, but they're willingly dodging information requests from the public who have, under Georgia law, a right to this information.
Well, I know that's really interesting, isn't it? And I think one of the things that I think happened as a result of the fact that you did shine light upon all of that, and then the legislature took action, I think that it has stopped others from trying to do anything similar. But this U.S. Alliance for Election Excellence, I think it's very, very dangerous. And they are burrowing into election offices. And I've noticed that I haven't seen any announcement since last November when they made their first big announcement of their election offices of excellence. And then after they made that announcement, citizens started asking questions about it. I haven't seen another announcement of the next round of here at the Centers of Excellence. Now we just have to try to get citizens to file those FOIA requests or open records requests to try to find out what they're doing.
Yeah, and actually you had two counties in North Carolina that became Alliance members, but said, no, we're not going to take any money because it looks very suspicious to us. Ottawa County in Michigan said, no, we're not going to become an Alliance. After they originally became an Alliance member, said, no, we don't want the money. Get us out of this Alliance. So election offices around the country are taking notice. Their strategy for the Alliance is actually very interesting because originally the model was, okay, you sign on to become a member of the Alliance as an election office. There's a fee that you have to pay, but we're going to give you scholarship money to cover that fee. And then you can use that scholarship as credits to purchase services from the Alliance, things like how to respond, consulting on how to respond to media and inquiries from citizens and things like that. But they've kind of shifted that strategy a little bit because of these Zuckbuck bans that all these states have, to where now they're offering like these very low membership fees, to where now essentially the idea is, well, they're paying us to join the Alliance, and therefore, you know, it's not us just giving them money. So that's kind of the gymnastics that they're using, I guess you could say, legal gymnastics, to get election offices into the Alliance.
Have you... I read something early on about the fact that as part of being a member of the Alliance, that these jurisdictions are, these election offices are supposed to turn over proprietary non-public data about their voters, about their procedures, their voting machines and processes. Have you, did you run across anything like that? Do you have any thoughts about how we might learn more about that?
Right. So in the application process to become an Alliance member, they will ask you a series of questions talking about what you need as a election office. What are your biggest needs? What are your biggest, shortcomings? Essentially, getting these election offices to forfeit all of this information to them willingly. And actually, one of the sections in the Alliance application is a recommendation section. So you as an election office, you can recommend another county election office to become an Alliance member. And in DeKalb's application, Preston Stevens, he actually recommended that Clayton County, another deep blue Democrat friendly county in Georgia, to become an Alliance member. So they're actively getting these election offices to forfeit information that otherwise they wouldn't be able to obtain through any other means. So that's the pretty scary part about this.
Yeah, I think it's pretty insidious. And of course, Mark Zuckerberg said, well, he wasn't going to do any more funding like he did in 2020. And so enter Bill Gates and the Audacious Project. yet another left-wing billionaire. You know, they just keep coming. And it gets a little daunting when I think about how much money they're spending on things like this. And I liken it to that they say they're going to help make these election offices just be better at running elections. And I liken it to what if a group of boosters for the Kansas City Chiefs said, we're going to train referees for the Super Bowl to be better referees at the Super Bowl. Because we think that, you know, we just want to have them be better referees. And I think, how would everybody feel about that? People wouldn't think that that was a good idea to have one team, big money supporters come in and training the people who are supposed to be neutral. And that, to me, is what the U.S. Alliance is all about.
Yeah, I can't remember what state it was, but somebody was testifying in favor of a Zuckbucks ban bill. And they basically said, imagine, to the Democrats on the committee, they said, imagine if Donald Trump or the Koch brothers or another GOP mega donor was funding election offices in battleground states around the country in the lead up to an election. I'd like to think that members of this committee on both sides of the aisle would be concerned about that. That's really what this is about. You know, for all their talk about partisan influence in the elections, they don't care that Mark Zuckerberg or any of these other left-wing groups or millionaires or billionaires are pouring their money, their influence into the election process, which is supposed to be a nonpartisan process.
Well, it's supposed to be run by the government. And that was actually a big reform over a century ago, was to get the election system out of the hands of being run by the political parties or ward healers, or basically the parties and the campaigns, and to have it run by the government so that it would be neutral. And we're just seeing, I think, a return to the way it was before all of those. Interestingly, the progressives were the ones who promoted all that in the early 20th century. The progressives today are leading the way to return it to the way where the process itself is controlled by one team.
Yeah, you really have to admire the chutzpah of Democrats, the lengths that they're willing to go to interfere in the electoral process. They'll use nonprofits, they'll use billionaires, they'll use the intelligence state. I mean, doesn't matter. They're just going to find a way to get in there.
And the leftist media is all the while cheering them on and calling us the bad guys. I particularly love that part. Well, look, Sean, I mean, you've been such a great, you're such a great resource, and it's really important. The work that you do is really important. And I just want you to know that you're very much appreciated. And I hope people will follow you.
Yeah, the best way you can find me is at thefederalist.com. If you want to read more of my work, you can go there, go under a contributor section and click on my bio. You can see all my articles. And then social media wise, I primarily just use Twitter at Sean Fleetwood. So if you want to find me and give me a follow, that'd be awesome.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for joining me today. Thanks for all you do. And we're going to post some links to some of your great articles. You're just doing great work. And it's important to have a voice that is following the election integrity movement and doesn't just beat up on us all the time. So thank you. Thank you for all your good work. So thanks for joining us. And that is it for our episode this week. Thanks a lot for being with us. We hope that you will follow up and go to thefederalist.com. Sign up, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends, and subscribe to the Who's Counting podcast. Go to our website, whoscounting.us, and learn how you can become involved in the election integrity process in your hometown, in your county, in your state. And with that, we'll say goodbye. We'll see you next week. Thanks so much. Thank you for joining Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Please help us fight big tech censorship. Like and subscribe to this podcast, and be sure to share it with your friends. You can become part of this election integrity movement by signing up to join the Election Integrity Network. Go to whoscounting.us. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Election Integrity Network.